All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am Jay Taylor. I'm talking to you from New York City on the first day of September 2020. And I do want to remind you that I write a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. You can sign up for that by going to miningstocks.com. We like to plug Chen Lin's letter, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? Go to chenpicks.com for that. And we also like to plug Michael Oliver's wonderful letter as well. OliverMSA.com is the place to go for that. And we're fortunate to have Michael with us. He'll, in just a few minutes, we'll be getting his comments on various important issues. So I do want to thank all of you for listening to this show and making it one of the top shows on the Voice America Business Channel. And also, really do read everything you send along to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. Questions, the number four, taylor@gmail.com. And, of course, we want to thank our sponsors because without them there would be no show. Our sponsors for this week, Benchmark Metals, NV Gold, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Novo Resources, Sitka Gold Corp, Lion One Metals. And I do want to welcome two new sponsors this week, Grand Portage and GMV Minerals. As with all sponsors in this show, these are companies that I have recommended in my newsletter and that I have purchased personally as well. It's a time when we can pick and choose the companies that we have as sponsors because there's so many good ones out there. With money and capital moving into the gold sector and the mining exploration sector, this is the best time of my life in terms of this industry. There's a lot of other things that aren't so good going around, but the mining sector is certainly one of those bright spots, the precious metals sector especially. In just a few minutes, I'll be speaking to Michael Hudson. He is the president of Hannon Metals. They have a massive sedimentary-hosted copper-silver project in Peru, just absolutely enormous. It's one of those projects that's certainly way beyond what a small junior mining company can handle. I wouldn't be surprised at all if we see Hannon announcing a major mining company coming into the picture sometime. Well, I don't know how soon, but I think it's almost going to happen because there's so few new projects like this one out there that the big copper guys have to have. So keep your eyes on Hannon, and of course, as I say, we'll be talking to Michael Hudson in just a few minutes from now. Another sponsor of mine, Lion One, came up with some spectacular news this past week, providing further confirmation that it is on to a major alkaline gold deposit that is in Fiji. I'll be passing along some of this exciting information to my readers this weekend in my newsletter. And one of the biggest sleepers, I believe, among my sponsors is Sitka Gold Corp. Now, selling at around 20 cents in U.S., I'm expecting to have Corwin Coe, he's the president of the company, on the show next week with us. But he has a drill campaign going on in Nevada and looking for a Carlin-style deposit as well as a Yukon. And again, with such a minuscule market cap, these are the kinds of stocks that can just absolutely explode in percentage terms, much, much higher levels. So next week, Corwin Coe, assuming he's available, and I think he will be. And I've seen some naysayers comment about Novo Resources in recent days. Investors seem disappointed that the stock hasn't moved all that much in recent months. But you have to keep in mind that Novo is at that point in time in its cycle. It's made its discovery, and now it's doing the engineering and getting ready for production. The acquisition of a mill recently means that it's going to be moving production time up very markedly. In fact, I think we may start to see some production before the end of the year. What I think most people are missing is the fact that this new mechanical separation technology that has come along is going to be a game changer for Novo. I think for a lot of other companies as well. Dr. Henning has talked about this issue on my show a couple of times, but I really truly believe that people don't understand how good the how robust the profit margin should be using this new technology, and as well the extent and the massive amount of ground and ounces that Novo will be able to come up with in the years ahead. Well, those are my views anyway. I'm not saying that you should go to the bank or you should go and buy the stock right now. Just on my words, you need to really do your own due diligence on all of these companies. But, of course, I try to help you do that with my newsletter. Go to miningstocks.com if you'd like to sign up. I also want to mention my course. Thanks to our son, Scott, who suggested, Dad, I think there's a lot of new people wanting to get into this industry, wanting to buy gold and silver and other related products. Why don't you write a why don't you provide a course for them? So I've now completed the filming of this course. I've titled it Investing 101, Gold and Silver in the Mining Shares. And the first couple of courses will have to do with the economic and political events that are taking place not only in the United States but around the world that have set the stage for what I believe is most certainly the biggest gold bull market for gold and silver in my lifetime. The third lesson will talk about different ways that you can invest in gold and silver and the different derivative products that are out there, including the gold shares and silver shares. In the fourth lesson, I'm going to talk about the economics of mining and what you need to look for with these junior exploration companies, because as soon as they start exploring for a project, you have to keep asking yourself, can this be a mine? And then, you know, either make a decision to stay or to get out of that stock based on the conclusions. And then in the fifth lesson, Dr. Quentin Henning, who is the most sought-after exploration geologist in the world, he's provided a very insightful dialogue with me and basically telling us what he looks for before he decides to get involved. And many companies want Dr. Quentin Henning to be involved with them as they explore and develop projects. Well, he can't sign up with all of them. So what does he look for? What really excites him about a project and causes him to sign on as an advisor to these various companies? And then Chen Lin will also be with me in the fifth lesson. He'll talk about what he uses, the combination of trading and investing, to do a remarkably great job in terms of his return on investment. So, and just a tremendous successful investor over the last number of years since I've learned to know him. The topic of today's show is an unexpected systemic crisis for sure. Alistair MacLeod and Michael Oliver, and as I said, Michael Hudson, will be with me today. Now, Alistair stated in his August 13th essay, and I quote, "Downturns in bank credit expansion always lead to systemic problems. We are on the edge of such a downturn, which, thanks to everyone's focus on COVID-19, is unexpected. On March 23, markets stopped worrying about deflation and realized that monetary inflation is the certain outlook. That day, the Fed promised unlimited monetary stimulus for both consumers and businesses, and the dollar began to fall. Commercial banks everywhere are massively leveraged, and their exposure to bad debts and a cyclical banking crisis is now certain to wipe many of them out." End of quote. Well, Alistair will talk about the impact on these market events and the impact on the dollar, and by extension, the price of gold that's denominated in dollars, of course. And he has really focused on the globally systemic important banks, the G-SIBs for short. Those are topics that he'll be talking about, very important. And also, I want to ask him his latest thoughts on the digital currencies that central banks now seem to be getting ready to try to implement. So we should be some very interesting discussions with Alistair MacLeod in the second half of today's show. Right after the first commercial break, Michael Hudson will be with me. He heads up, as I said, Hannon Metals, to talk about the wonderful things that are going on down there in Peru with that fantastic sedimentary deposit, copper and silver deposit in Peru. But right now, I'm really happy to tell you that Michael Oliver is back, and I'm trying to talk as fast as I can so we can find as much time as possible for Michael, because people are out there complaining, Taylor, you talk too much. Shut your mouth and let Michael talk. So thanks for joining me, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
Yeah, so let's talk about the markets that are really have you most interested right now. The dollar seems to be getting weaker, as Alistair MacLeod mentioned. He says it started around March 23rd. But what are your thoughts about the dollar and then some of the other key markets that we look at?
Well, the dollar is a major bear right now. In fact, it's been a major bear for a handful of decades. If you look back at the dollar index back in the 70s and 80s, it's a big, big, huge layered declines. And it's resumed. The action of the last 2 months for us convinced us that the major sell signal we issued in early 2017 is back on course. We even did a study of a 10-year average oscillator of the dollar. Normally, when we look at annual, we look at 3-year and that kind of thing. But no, 10-year. The 10-year says if you drop to 91 cash dollar index, right now it's trading at 92 area. If you drop down to 91 this year, you're likely to drop rapidly to 84.
Wow.
As the next step. Now, that doesn't seem like a big deal, but in foreign exchange, the major currencies, that kind of percent drop is huge.
Mm-hmm.
It's single digit, but it's huge. So it's effectively a crash-type drop. So if the dollar hits 91, I think it could be another rapid drop here. So watch that 91 level. No doubt that'll have impact on other markets or reflect other events that are going on. Gold's behaving quite well. Silver, of course, has come to life like a monster. And we think it will remain the monster of the gold-silver market. We think it will be the leader. Mm-hmm. And I strongly suspect that the two peaks at $50 over the last several decades will come out by next year sometime. And I don't know where silver's going on the upside, nor do I know on gold in terms of ultimately. We're facing a swirly in the world, political, economic, philosophical, monetary, you know, you name it. It's all coming together now.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't just look at gold and silver and technically analyze them and say, well, you know, they're going to do this or that. You got to look at the T-bond market, which we think is living on its last leg. So right now I still think there could be one more surge in the bond market as a flight to safety from the stock market at some point here in the next few months. But beyond that, then the bond market looks vulnerable in terms mm-hmm. of lower prices, higher yield. That will be a dramatic scare event if that occurs. Right now, you buy bonds when stocks are weak. Okay, they're inverse. But mm-hmm. if yields ever started to rise on a trending basis, that would be very negative for stocks, and they would be joined at the hip at that point in terms of downside. Downside in price and bonds, downside in stocks. So we're looking for that, but probably that's a next year event. Mm-hmm. The Bloomberg Commodity Index has broken out. Our first breakout level, it occurred the end of yesterday, so the end of the month. And we think there's likely a major surge coming in the broad commodity category between now and the end of the year. And by major, Bloomberg Commodity Index right now is trading at 73 area. Now, if you go back and look over the last decade or so, it's been up, you know, to 180 or something. So, you know, it's not exactly expensive. We think this surge could go to 110 to 120 very rapidly. Well, you do the math on something that's 70 and going to 120, let's say, that's a huge percent gain.
Yeah, sure.
And we think it could unfold in a matter of, you know, a quarter or two. So, again, for our subscribers, we prescribe very specific numbers that are trigger numbers, and we've hit one of them this last month, and there's another one not far above. And I think that would shock a lot of markets, because I don't think anybody's really looking at a broad commodity upturn. Mm-hmm. They're so used to it being deflated. And that'll affect things, like, you know, bond yields. People long bonds will have to start to think again.
that's really right. And I wonder, if yields start to rise like that, Michael, then it means the central banks are losing control, I would think.
Over the long end of the market, yes, I quite agree. And I think they will lose control over the long end of the market. They may control the overnight, but that won't matter. Also, if you are continued to be mesmerized like Trump is of the V-bottom and the new highs in the stock market, stand back and really look at the stock market, okay? Don't just look at the NASDAQ 100, which is being driven by six symbols that comprise 48% of that index weighting that are causing it to go vertical. Look at the fact that the Dow is not making new highs. New York Composite Index is not making new highs. Russell 2000 is not making new highs. The Euro Stoxx 50, the blue chips of Europe, are not making new highs. It's a very narrow event, and it's very delusional. Another thing struck me there, how much time do we have left, Jay?
Take another minute or two.
Another minute or two. Pause on this issue. The Venezuelan, the Caracas, Venezuela stock market is up 1,000% this year.
Wow. Yeah.
Does that matter?
No, not if the currency's worthless.
Well, I mean, the currency, the M2 of Venezuela, is up 1,000%.
Yeah.
So when the Federal Reserve starts to put the pedal and drive our M2 vertically, and it is going vertical, quit paying so much attention to nominal prices if the money unit is being degraded rapidly. Because, yeah, no, we're not Venezuela yet, but, you know, we're getting to be some version of Venezuela, and that we're driven by the degradation in the money unit. So at that point, it's possible you could have every asset in the world going up, and it doesn't matter. The issue becomes, for an investor, which assets have least risk and the greatest percent gain potential. Mm-hmm. And we argue it's gold, silver, and commodity category in that order. And the other stuff that's looking good right now is probably either going to lag or actually go down. Mm-hmm. So it's time to put your thinking hat on and not just look at nominal new highs, quote unquote.
Well, you're talking about money money supply in Venezuela. I would suggest some of the things we're seeing in places like Portland and Seattle and Minneapolis and Chicago and New York and elsewhere around the country looks a little bit like what we used to see in Venezuela as well. But that's another that's another story. Just real quickly, maybe 30 seconds or so, you mentioned when we had you on for a longer period last week that you were quite certain that Biden would win. And somebody didn't like to hear that sent an email in. And I said, well, you know. So what are your thoughts about that? Because I think
my thoughts are that we're headed for the giant swirly of errors that we've been compounded over decades, and especially since 2009. These are financial, monetary, and they're based on philosophical, political philosophy errors.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, they cause real-world consequences. The issue now for Trump is he was suffering badly in the polls. RCP average showed him down 7% or so. That's changing a bit. And what's changing is the fear factor. And the fear factor, of course, is directly connected to the events that are about to unfold. And some of them are going to be violent, and they're going to get more and more violent, I suspect. I'm not encouraging it. I'm just saying that's just the reality out there. And we're seeing it happen. And as if those events continue to escalate between now and the election, then the election is a toss-up. Trump might actually pull it out. Now, I would argue this. By the way, Jeff Deist of the Mises Institute made this same point, so I'm in effect echoing what he said. Regardless of the outcome, we're in a crisis. But the Democrats, if they won, it would be more peaceful initially in the first few months after the election. But if Trump is elected, expect violence rapidly.
Yeah.
I suspect the left is going to explode.
Yeah, well, you would think
so. In mass if he got elected.
Right, given their reaction to the first time he was elected, I would agree with you. All right, Michael. Well, thank you. We'll have to leave it go at that. We're out of time and then some. But thank you so much for your valuable insights. Always appreciated. Well, folks, we are going to go to a break now. But when we come back, Michael Hudson will be with me to talk about Hannon Metals. Don't go away.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to have with me once again Michael Hudson of Hannon Metals. Michael is a director, CEO, and chairman of Hannon Metals. It's a company I've picked up earlier this year, actually real early this year, because my friend from 321 Gold, Bob Moriarty, picked this company as his top pick for the year. And I said, well, Bob's a pretty smart guy. I better take a look at it. And I'm really glad I did, because we've already done very well with the stock in my newsletter. And so I'm really happy to have Michael with me, because they have, I think Hannon has a project that is, you really want to keep your eyes on. So it has a great deal of potential. That's why I'm really happy that Michael could join me today. Thanks, Michael.
Pleasure to be back.
I'm really glad to have you here with us. When we look at the project, your project is in Peru, and you're sort of landlocked in Australia right now. How are things going there with your project? San Martin project. It's a copper silver sedimentary hosted project that it's absolutely enormous. The target is huge. But have you been able to get some work done in spite of COVID-19, Michael?
Jay, simple answer is not a lot on the ground, but a lot from a remote point of view, I suppose, is the reality. We do have people on the ground, but they're local people working from a social licensing point of view. So what has been happening in Peru is terrible. I think it's up there in the top 4 in terms of cases. It spread from Lima, which has reasonable medical care, out into the regions many months ago, which have less support. And then we're very fortunate. I'm sitting here in Australia, where we can literally pay people not to work, but people in Peru don't have that benefit. So they need to get out there in society and earn a daily wage to keep their family fed, essentially. So it's very hard for them to contain it like it has been elsewhere. So the outcomes have been very, very bad. And San Martin, which is the project name we're working in, it's also named after the department or the province in which we're working, is still in lockdown. There's 6 or 7 provinces in lockdown in Peru. They've opened up some of the country. But the reality is that most people are not working in Peru. There may be a few exceptions, but there's a whole lot of risks for staff. There's a whole lot of risks for local people. And then there's a whole lot of reasons that local people, wherever they are, whether it's here in Australia or in the jungles of Peru, don't want foreigners, essentially people from outside the area, coming in, because there's that fear. So no, we haven't done anything on the ground since March, but we've been working very hard, and there's been a regular news flow. So we had a lot of work done at the start of this year. So that took us many months past March, up until only a couple of months ago, we were having samples returned. And then we've been able to do a lot of work remotely in terms of satellite interpretation and really sitting down and pulling together some of the information and data that we've had. So the project's certainly advanced, but outside of the social work, which is critical, the most important part, we haven't had geologists there, but helping with medical supplies and food packs and all those things that are the most critical thing, really. I mean, geology can wait. This is a huge opportunity, and it's been there for hundreds of millions of years, essentially, and it's not going anywhere in this world. But the most important thing we can do is support the communities at the moment.
Right, and certainly curry some good favor, some good political favor, just by doing the right thing, by helping those people at this point in time. That's very good. And so, talk a little bit about what you've been able to discover remotely about your project. And maybe before you talk about that, talk about the size of the project for people that don't know it. Maybe there's a reason to be very excited about this project. Yeah, it's been, you know, not as active as you'd like it to be, but I'm very excited about your project. But tell our listeners that may not be familiar with it what the possibilities are for this San Martin project. And I look on your map and I see there are four areas, very extensive areas on this huge property, the San Martin property, where you've gathered up high-grade copper, silver assays. And so I suppose those are some of your top targets, are they?
They are at the moment. It's as we've said, early days. So we're a first mover into this basin, and we secured tenure from late 2018 all through 2019 and really got on the ground at the end of 2019 and at the start of this year, 2020, started to pull the project and understanding to vast area. As you've said, we've got tenure, mining concessions over 120 kilometres, and the target we've got this sediment hosted copper. Now, sediment hosted copper is the second most prolific form of copper mined in the world after porphyry coppers. So they form very large deposits. The Kupfer Schiefer in Poland or the Central African Copper Belt are the key examples. And we've got another style here. It's slightly different, but it's the same model, and it extends over such large areas. We're seeing basically pancake levels of copper and silver, and there's quite a significant silver credit here. The Kupfer Schiefer in Poland is the world's largest single silver producer, even though it's a byproduct from the copper mines there.
Yeah.
So this is a copper silver play, and what your question was specifically, what have we been able to do remotely to narrow it down? So we've just got on the ground over the last 8 to 12 months essentially, and had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of samples, thousands of samples that we've been able to put in context geologically into that pancake layer, if you like, over such a vast area. But because it's it's jungle area, it's very hard work. You know, you're literally cutting your way. I mean, we've done the easy stuff along roads, and then we cut our way through the forest. So everything is sort of a bit jumbled and out of context as we're making the discoveries. But we've been able to come back with satellite data, and there's some amazing the resolution of satellite data available to civilians these days is quite incredible. So we've been able to map the geological formations from that satellite information and put all those samples in context and become predictive, importantly, where further mineralized samples have the potential to exist. So the project's in a much bigger framework. We've de-risked it a lot, and that's really essentially what we do as geologists, de-risks the projects and hopefully some of them progress towards mines. And I mean, that's a long way down the path, but we've advanced the project significantly, I think, is the summary comment.
And so you say pancake-like. Are they flat-lying structures, as far as you know, at this stage?
Yeah, it's essentially flat-lying. It's dipping at about 30 degrees and for the most part, not flat as in horizontal. But it's an important point because these sediment-hosted systems are generally quite thin. I mean, in the Kupfer Schiefer in Poland, it averages around 3 meters thickness, but it continues over tens and tens of kilometers, and they do blow out to tens of meters thickness, but for the most part, they're quite thin. And so potential mineability is important in anything we look at, even at early stage exploration. And if we had vertical bodies, they'd be much, much harder to mine. In fact, almost impossible to mine economically. But having a shallowly dipping bodies makes them the mining techniques that we could use in those styles of bodies, and room and pillar is specifically the type that we'd use in a shallowly dipping body, it's much more economic. So, you know, if this was all upright and vertical, it would be of much less of interest. So it's simple things like orientation count.
Sure. Oh, very important. And you can't get in there to work now, so obviously you're not going to be drilling anytime soon, I suppose. I mean, we're always looking for drill results on these early projects.
Absolutely. Our aim was to hopefully be drilling by the end of this year. Right? We saw an 8-month process to permitting, and we were looking to just start that back in March, and that did not happen, the start of that permitting process, because everything else happened around the world very quickly. there at that period of time. So drilling is absolutely critical. Early drilling is very important to understand projects as well as giving good numbers and excitement to the market. And it is the, as we all call it, the truth detector. It's a true sampling methodology to determine what you have and put it into three dimensions. The good news is, I suppose, is that there's a whole lot of new laws and regulations being talked about all around the world, and Peru is no different. So the new laws in Peru are specifically around reinvigorating the economy and promoting development post-COVID. And one of the big issues in Peru has always been, over the last number of years, the slowness of permitting. But they're talking about bringing in new ways to fast track essentially that process. So So what may have been, you know, a 8 to 12 month process will hopefully be a lot less as Peru, as amongst other countries, want to build out quickly post development here or post COVID and get things working. So hopefully, you know, when we can get back on the ground, and that's still a moving target, there'll be a backlog, no doubt. But the government is talking, and up to the Prime Minister level, about streamlining these permitting processes.
You know, I just looking at a lot of your assays, people need to know that this is, you know, these are pretty spectacular assays. You know, I'm looking here at 2.7% copper, and these are surface samples, of course, so we want to see that third dimension. But 29 grams per ton silver, which is a nice nice silver credit, as you say. But I mean, this is not, I mean, there's higher grades of both of those metals as well in many samples. But just very extensive on surface, right? I mean, it's just mind-boggling in a way, because the potential is, we don't know yet, of course, until you really start to drill it. But it seems to me, Michael, that you've got a project that is so large here. I would think that there would likely be some big guys, some big companies that might have some interest in what you're doing down there. Am I out of line in suggesting that?
No, you're not, absolutely. And we have put it in our public disclosure that we are talking to a number of different parties because the question is asked a lot, and it's no surprise. New copper projects are hard to find. New copper basins are even harder to find. Mm-hmm. And we're in a frontier area that has seen very little work. We've benefited, and we've talked about it before, about the petroleum exploration of the 90s, and that data has become freely available only very recently, and we believe we're the first group to pull that data apart. So it's given us a fast track to the geological understanding. But you know, there's a number of large copper companies around the world, and it's their job to know what's happening, and no doubt they've been knocking on our door as they would and should. And that's what I used to do as a geologist in a big company, was to make sure I was up to date with what was happening around the world. And we're in discussion with a number of parties, and nothing else material has happened outside of that. Otherwise, we'd be obliged to put it in the public domain. But we have talked about that, and without wanting to trump it up too much, it's something that happens quite a lot. But this, simply put, this is a target for the big major mining companies. Right. This is not small, and it has attracted a lot of interest.
Right. Of course, you're not thinking at all about being a producer. You're an exploration geologist and have a really good one with a great track record. And all I can say is, as a shareholder, I just hope you don't let it go too cheap if someone comes at you. You know, I mean, we've done very well. I don't know, 3-4 times our money, I suppose, since we told our subscribers about it. But I'm looking for something considerably larger. Maybe I'm being greedy, but it seems to me the potential is just enormous here, and it's very exciting. Our listeners need to know there's no such thing as a sure thing in this business. It's exploration. It's high risk, high return. And I think this has a chance for the high return part of that equation. So, Michael, anything else you'd like to add before we finish today?
We haven't stopped, basically, Jay. We've got our tenure, and a lot of it is being granted, and it's still being granted as we speak. So we've got over 50% of the applications granted now. So that's progressing. But our work has actually identified more opportunities in the area in which we're working, and so we're working behind the scenes. So there's the anticipation of more, and I can say that with confidence.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you, Michael, very much for sharing your time with us and bringing us up to date on your very exciting story there in Peru. Well, that's it for this segment. Be right back, though, with Alistair McLeod, who has some very, very important things to talk about, specifically in the banking sector. He thinks there's some real problems brewing ahead, so don't go away. We'll be right back with Alistair McLeod.
Gold Core, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTC, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in North America. With an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2020, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors including Eric Sprott, a globally recognized technical team, technical coverage from industry gold experts, and cash in its treasury. Visit nvgoldcore.com to learn more on this exciting story.
Benchmark Metals is a gold-silver exploration company that is embarking on its largest program to date on the Lawyers Project, with up to 50,000 meters of resource expansion and definition drilling planned in 2020. The multi-million-ounce potential project is expected to have a new mineral resource estimate and PEA study completed in 2021. The company is backed by the Metals Group management team and believes this aggressive program will be complemented by one of the strongest commodity bull markets in decades. Visit BenchmarkMetals.com and subscribe to follow their success.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Alistair McLeod, who's certainly one of the most frequent guests on this show by popular demand, no doubt about that. And so thanks for joining me again, Alistair.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
It's always good to have you with us, and because of your insights in the markets, and not only, you know, anybody can see this is going up and that's going down and this is going sideways, but why are they, what's behind, what's driving the markets so that we can understand and maybe plan for the future. But I want to talk to you about an article that you've written on August 13th. But before we get to that, I'd like to ask you again maybe to review for our listeners the repo market problems that occurred last September and why that's important even now.
Yes, we've almost forgotten that we had liquidity problems in the banking system as early as September last year. And to refresh your listeners' minds, basically the repo rate, which basically is short-term borrowing, if you like, short-term liquidity borrowing, it leapt up to about 10% early in September. And the Fed had to intervene because obviously if you've got overnight money running at 10%, that stands in a huge contrast against the Fed funds rate, which at that time was something like 1.5 to 2%. I can't remember the exact level, but it was a big, big difference and it needed sorting. So the Fed stepped in and started supplying the market. Now, we never quite knew why it was that there was suddenly this huge, great liquidity problem. I mean, I noted at the time that it happened on the day when Deutsche Bank sold its prime brokerage to BNP. Now, it's quite possible that the hedge funds didn't go with the accounts. And the result was that there was a shortage for either one of those banks or possibly both of those banks that led to that spike in rates. But it took a long time to sort out. And we should note that when banks have liquidity problems, this becomes extremely serious. And not only that, but you have the possibility, and it becomes very possible, that you could be heading into some sort of banking crisis, dislocation, systemic issue, however you like to put it. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, my mind, was the importance of that occurrence. And it also happened at the time when international trade more or less crashed off a cliff because of the trade dispute between America and China. And, various countries were beginning to go into recession. Germany, for example, whose major trading partner was China, entered a recession. And this was, there were ramifications of what had been happening. And furthermore, it was after about 10 years of a credit cycle of bank credit expansion. And it was clear that that was very, very mature and likely to end. Now, the problem is that when you get an end in the credit cycle, you are, as often as not, it happens actually quite suddenly, and banks have liquidity problems. So that September, did it mark the end of the expansion of bank credit? It probably did, though it's difficult to say that that's the case by looking at numbers such as money supply numbers and so on and so forth. This is the sort of thing that comes out of the woodwork after the event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seemed to me for the longest time we Americans could live beyond our means as long as we could depend on the kindness of strangers, is the way it was put. The exporting nations, the nations that had lots of dollars from their net exports, would just recycle them into treasuries. But it seemed to me that back in September, that was part of the issue, that there was, and you point to the trade dispute between China and, a lot of different issues coming together there. But would you say that was really starting to come into play, where America maybe could no longer depend, especially at these interest rates, could no longer depend on the kindness of strangers as we once did?
Yes, that's undoubtedly true. The foreigners maintain very large dollar investments. Now, the reason they fundamentally do that is that they look ahead, if you like, to the trading relationship with America from their point of view. And if they see it expanding, then obviously they're going to want more dollars, which they hold in the form of cash through corresponding banking networks. They hold it in the form of investments in U.S. treasuries, portfolio investments on the stock market, and so on and so forth. So you've got a full range of securities. Now, over time, this has actually built up to a huge number. We're looking at about $21 trillion worth of securities, and by that I mean equities, bonds, and so on and so forth. And then you've got, on top of that, you've got a further $5 billion odd of bills, which include treasury bills, commercial bills, and so on, and also bank balances, bank deposits, which are all reflected in the banking system in New York. Now, as soon as you start saying to these people, look, the outlook is that trade is going to contract, then at that stage, they begin to think, we've got too many dollars for our future requirements. Mm-hmm. So at that stage, they start lightening up. And you can see that, it didn't hit the markets initially, but certainly we've seen the dollar really tank from that March 23rd high when it peaked at 102, and now it's down about 10%. So, the foreigners are beginning to sell, and that is a bit of a headache for the Fed trying to fund a ballooning budget deficit.
Mm-hmm. And Michael Oliver told us in the first segment today that if we see 91 on the dollar index, his technical work is suggesting that we could be looking at 84 fairly quickly. So that would be a huge decline in a fairly short period of time. So, if going back to September was sort of a canary in the coal mine, so to speak, I think you maybe have spotted another one in the G-SIBs. That is the what's the acronym stands for, globally systemic important banks or something like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's global systemically important banks, and they're required to hold an extra level of liquidity compared with a normal bank, because obviously, I mean, the lesson, if you like, that was learned from the great financial crisis was that if a big bank it needs to be rescued, you got a real problem. So the answer was that these banks need to have at least a cash cover for at least 30 days commitments going forward, you know, looking out, if you like, from on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. But the G-SIBs actually have ended up, the American ones are by and large in pretty good condition. There's only one which is a bit questionable, and that's Wells Fargo. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the European banks, I mean, it is actually frightening. The Societe Generale has a price-to-book ratio of around about 18%. In other words, investors are valuing the equity in that bank at less than 20% of book value.
Wow.
Now, if you apply that, bearing in mind that what the regulators look at is the relationship between total assets and balance sheet equity. But if you reckon that, if you see that the market is valuing that balance sheet equity at only 18% on a price to book level, then you've got a new level of leverage which you've got to really consider. And in the case of Societe Generale, that is around about 115 to 118 times.
Gee.
What that means is that if Societe Generale has to write off a euro, the effect on the equity, if you like, is like 118 times on the value of that equity. Equity is priced in markets, so we're talking notionally, obviously. Mm-hmm. But you can see that the markets are in effect saying that there is a huge question mark over the future of Societe Generale, Deutsche Bank, Group Crédit Agricole, and in the British ones, Barclays. And we've got another problem, and that is with America roughing up Hong Kong. We've got Hong Kong Shanghai Bank and Standard Chartered, and their shares are at their 52-week lows, which is the other thing which I look at. If shares are hitting their 52-week lows, then there is trouble ahead.
Yeah, and they've hit their 52-week lows while the indexes, at least, are hitting new highs in the U.S. You know, we know there's just a few of the tech stocks primarily that are responsible for that, and the market isn't nearly as healthy over here. The equity market is healthy as it appears to be based on the indexes. But nonetheless, the fact that the banks are doing so terrible, so much worse, essentially, than most other equity market participants, right?
Yes, that's correct. There's also another worry. The mm-hmm. big Chinese banks, there are four Chinese banks listed in the G-SIB list. And there was a very strong performance in the Chinese, the Shanghai stock market, really running up to a peak, I think, on about the 7th of July. The banks initially went with it, and then their share prices collapsed and went all the way back. Now, I don't know what that's telling me. I mean, We either love or hate the Chinese, but the Chinese government, if you like, controls those banks, yet the mm-hmm. share prices pretty much collapsed. So, you know, does this tell us something? I don't know. I mean, the point I'm making is there is a lot of systemic risk around, and I mm-hmm. don't think anyone is paying attention to it.
Well, it wouldn't be a mystery why the markets might be looking at these banks and thinking that, you know, that their balance sheets aren't reflective of their true health, because you have, I think what you have, I don't know if you would call this a depression, it's certainly a global recession with the COVID-19 on top of the other issues that you talked about. So why wouldn't there be massive losses, bank losses? And all these banks are leveraged to the hilt. So, I mean, it just seems logical that why would you want to buy bank stocks right now unless you really are confident that the central banks can generate growth, through monetary stimulation, or you buy those that you know are going to be protected by the, you know, by the, you know, too big to fail banks, right? Maybe that'd be another reason to own them. But
it is extremely dangerous. I mean, I don't think I would own any bank shares at all. I'm not giving investment advice. No. This is my personal view. But what I am actually more worried about is, where I have my money deposited, which banks are safe. Now, there are small depositor protection schemes and all the rest of it. But, you know, if let's say you've sold a house and the lawyers are looking after your money in their client account, that is not protected. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are loopholes in this, which you could find out the hard way. And this is not a nice situation.
No. All right. Well, let's go on to another topic. You've looked at March 23rd. If September was a really important point in terms of that, in terms of the repo market, March 23rd you've pointed to as a very important date. Talk about that, if you would, please.
Yes, indeed. I mean, your listeners may remember that the market tanked in the first 2 months of this year. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the S&P lost fully one-third of its value. And then the Fed came out on March the 23rd, which was a Monday, and made a statement about what they were going to do about it. And basically, they said, we will do whatever it takes to rescue the economy. And this was just literally as the lockdowns were more or less happening. I think in this country, that was the date of our lockdown. And all the markets turned on a dime. They really did. You found that gold and silver suddenly started shooting higher. I mean, particularly silver. The gold-silver ratio started to collapse from 125, I think. And it's currently looking at 69, 70, something like that. And presumably it's got further to go. Copper, the price of copper shot up. The price of oil has also shot up, though there was an interruption in that, because if you remember, there were these delivery problems on the April contract where oil was being delivered and people were long of oil and they had nowhere to store it. So the price went negative.
Yeah,
but apart from that, I mean, the oil price has gone up quite substantially. Stocks of, I mean, the S&P turned round, and having lost a third, it has now regained all that and some. And as you point out, you know, there are elements in that are really performing, you know, the tech stocks. But it was a big moment. And we knew at that time that the Fed would do anything in its power, basically, which means that it would print money, even go into negative interest rates if necessary, etc. It would do absolutely everything it could to rescue the economy, to stop it going into a recession. And since then, of course, we have had massive monetary inflation. I was looking at the narrow money, M1, that statistic. And basically, from around about February, late February, in other words, just before all that happened, it has been expanding at an annual rate of 60%.
Wow.
Now, this is quite something. I mean, ahead of the Lehman crisis, the expansion on that money supply was about 8.8% per annum. That's a simple, you know, it's just a simple calculation. Following the Lehman crisis, it was 16.6%. In other words, it pretty much doubled. Now we're on 60. And not only that, but we have got yet more monetary expansion to come, simply because, as you point out, the economy is ready. You know, really very badly affected by COVID. You've got supply chain failures, the whole thing. The Fed is going to try and rescue the whole US economy and also, on top of that, the global economy, though they won't quite admit that. Yeah. So you can see that the amount of money printing that we're going to see in the coming months is going to even eclipse that increase of 60% that we have seen in the first half of this year.
Yeah, now what happens if we start having these banks start having problems, and then they have to bail the banks out and print more money for that? So it's very frightening in a way. I want to ask you about Jackson Hole, the speech by Chairman Powell. And I understand, should tell my listeners again, remind them, it's goldmoney.com for Alistair's essays that come out every Thursday. Alistair, I understand you're going to talk about what Chairman Powell had to say at Jackson Hole. Just explain to us why that's important and what, give us a little hint about what you might be writing on Thursday.
Yes. As I'm sure we're all aware now, Powell, at his virtual presence at Jackson Hole, shifted the goalpost slightly. Instead of a dual mandate, watching inflation, trying to keep that at around about 2%, and the unemployment rate, watching that and trying to keep it at a maximum level consistent with an inflation rate of 2%, he's basically said that you know, we're going to give more leeway on the inflation rate and concentrate on ensuring that people keep their jobs. Now, the problem I have with this is that the inflation rate which he's using is basically concocted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it says it's around about 1.6%, and it's been running at that sort of rate, really, for the last 10 years on average. So now, if it was that, if that was the case, I would have no concerns. But you have got in America two wonderful people who actually calculate this independently and independently of each other. You've got the Chapwood Index, and you have got John Williams, who I think you've had on your program.
Yes, absolutely, several times.
At Shadow Stats. And basically, I think I'm right in saying, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think John Williams calculates that on the 1981 basis of calculation, in other words, before they started mucking around with the numbers, the rate of inflation since the great financial crisis, after an initial dip, has been running at somewhere between 7 and 10%. The Chapwood Index, which examines the prices of 500 commonly bought goods in 50 cities, so that's 2,500 data points every 6 months, has come to the conclusion that, and there's quite a bit of variance between cities, incidentally, but in rough terms, over the last 10 years, the inflation rate has actually been around about 10% on that basis, year in, year out. And in fact, on the most recent figures, which are up to the end of June, it's actually picked up a bit. So inflation is picking up, if you like, on that level. So we have a situation where Chairman Powell is now saying he's going to downgrade the inflation, the importance of inflation, working off the BLS figures, 1.6%, when actually, if you look at the US economy, the real rate of price inflation has been running at closer to 10%. Now, you know, this basically means that the US economy has been in a slump ever since the great financial crisis. Now, this is terribly important because the only thing that has offset that has been the inflation of financial assets. So, you know, we've all enjoyed lovely share price rises, bond yields have been kept low, which means bond prices are high. And so all those wonderful things, if you have a lot of money and you play the stock market.
Right, exactly.
But for the guys in Main Street, and particularly, you know, the poor, the elderly, and the underclass, I mean, is there any surprise you've got riots? I mean, you know, this is quite simply appalling.
Yeah, it's devastating. Unfortunately, we're just about out of time, Alistair, but I would say that that is just – Powell is just being consistent with what he said back in March 23rd then, I guess you would agree, and that they're ready to let inflation run hot. Do you think they really believe the 1.6% inflation rate? We do have to run, but just your quick thought on that.
Yes, I think they do because they have got no option but to believe in it. They have to believe it, and we all have to believe it, because if you actually take seriously what Chapwood and John Williams are saying, your economy is screwed completely.
Exactly, and so we would do well not to believe it. And, you know, people on this show know what they're supposed to do with their loose change. Alistair, thank you so much for being with us again. We're out of time, never enough time with you, but thank you so much.
That's my pleasure.
We'll have to leave it go at that. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week. Next week, Bob Moriarty is my guest. And as I mentioned, Corwin Coe of Sitka Gold is also scheduled to be with me. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.